Right. Get our short review here. Which Old Testament king is Edward VI sometimes compared to, and why?
Josiah, because he was very young when he became king.
That's right. And he was a good king. How did the English Reformation fare under Edward VI's short reign?
Very well.
Yep. His father had him trained by Protestants, and he was sincerely devout to the Protestant faith. How many Roman Catholics were put to death during Edward VI's reign?
I don't think there were any.
That's right, none. All right, well, in contrast to Edward VI, we're going to look at the next ruler, which is Bloody Mary. So when Edward VI died, the crown went to his half-sister Mary, daughter of Henry VIII, and Catherine of Aragon. Now, you, of course, remember that this was the birth that caused all the problems in the first place with Henry VIII. Henry VIII was wanting a son. He was married to Catherine of Aragon, and she gave him a daughter. He blamed that on her, and so he wanted to get a divorce from her and marry someone else and who would hopefully give him a son. Well, this was the daughter that she gave him. And obviously that's going to figure into, now that she's grown up and has memory of all that happened, it's going to figure into the things that happened, and it's going to shape her life and the way that she governs. Mary had always been a Catholic, for in her experience, the movement of Reformation had begun with her own dishonor in her youth, when she'd been declared an illegitimate child. So in her mind, she blames the Reformation for that, because the Reformation came about in part because Henry withdrew from Catholicism, and from the, at least from the governing of the Pope. Furthermore, if Henry had been correct in proclaiming himself head of the church and his marriage to Catherine null and void, Mary was a bastard, and her right to succession could be cast into doubt. Therefore, for reasons both of conviction and political necessity, Mary was committed to the goal of restoring Roman Catholicism in England. So here we have a case of, with all of us, really, we're shaped by things that happen in our youth. We're shaped by things that the narrative that takes place around us. And in her mind, she blamed the Reformation for what happened to her. Of course, Henry was involved in that, and Cranmer and others. And she ended up coming up a very stout, staunch Catholic, and someone who hated the Reformation. In this task, she had the powerful support of her cousin, Charles V. Now, you remember Charles V, we've been looking at him quite a bit. He's the one who Luther had quite a bit of engagement with. He was the Holy Roman Emperor on the continent, and she was related to him. So she had his support. She also had a number of conservative English bishops who had been deposed during the previous reign. So as England was moving toward Protestantism, away from Catholicism, some of those who were still committed to Catholicism ended up being booted out of office or losing their positions or whatever, and she had some of those people who were ready to come right back in and offer her support in what she was wanting to do in moving the nation back away from Protestantism and toward Catholicism. But she knew she must move with caution. So during the first months of her reign, she took the time to consolidate her position within England while she strengthened her ties with the Catholic House of Habsburg by marrying her cousin Philip of Spain, later known as Philip II. So because there was a, you know, the nation had been moving toward Protestantism, there was a lot of popular support for Protestantism. Catholicism and its support was not dead. It was very much a divided nation, something we can relate to today in our politics for different reasons, obviously, but we have this very divided nation of two different sets of people who want two different sets of things to happen within the governing of the nation. That part we can relate to as far as that goes. And she knew she had to move cautiously at first, but as we'll see, once she was able to get to a position of power, she could throw caution to the wind. And many people thought at the time when there was a little bit of a dispute about her being appointed and so forth as the queen, that she was kind of a moderate and that she wouldn't really be all that hard once she got in office. We've heard that story before. And it didn't turn out to be the case with her. So she marries into the Hapsburg family. It's a very powerful family. And she solidifies her alliance with Spain, which, of course, is a strong Catholic nation, very strong. They were the ones who were hardest during the Inquisition. And so she's moving very much in the direction of Catholicism and solidifying power in that direction. And as soon as she felt herself secure on the throne, she began a series of increasingly repressive measures against Protestants. And this is where it begins to go dark. In late 1554, England officially returned to obedience to the Pope. So the first thing she did was she overturned what Henry VIII had put in place, which was, he said, we're no longer listening to the Pope, we're no longer under the Pope. She says, nope, now we're back under the Pope. Most of what had been done during the reigns of Henry and Edward was now undone. And again, we can relate to this in our day, right? We have presidents who are acting like kings, and they pass executive orders, and then the next president comes in who disagrees, and they just come along and undo all the things that the previous president did. And that's basically what the Queen is doing here. The feast days of the saints were restored, so the celebration of Catholic holidays and particularly of the saints, which Catholics love to do, that was put back in place. Married clergy were ordered to set their wives aside. A clergy had been allowed to marry, and she came in and said, too bad, you shouldn't have married, set your wives aside. Finally, open persecution of Protestant leaders became the policy of the kingdom, and this is where it really gets dark. Because it's for this reason the Queen acquired the name by which she's known to this day, which we have titled her in our section, Bloody Mary. Between 1555 and 1558, some 300 English Protestants were burnt at the stake, and another 100 died of maltreatment in prison. That is a lot of people, if you stop and think about it, in that short of a period of time. We're looking at about a 3 or 4-ish year period with about 400 people dying. I think I figured it out. It ends up being like about 2 a week or something like that. It's a lot of deaths going on for a very intensely, very constant, for a very long period of time. England had never known such a concentrated burst of religious persecution in its entire history. Most of the martyrs were obscure, ordinary men and women whose often joyful and triumphant deaths revealed an unsuspected depth of grassroots Protestant faith. So you would think that, you know, that she mostly would go after the leaders of the Protestant faith and the big names. And as we're going to see in a minute, she did do that. But her net brought in a lot of regular common folks. And the metal of the faith of those common folks was shown to be genuine, and they were proved to be true to their faith, as tragic as this is. And they shined in each in their own right. As I said, she did go after some of the famous Protestant leaders. That included Cranmer, Ridley, Latimer, and Hooper. Those are some names we've mentioned along the way. We looked at Cranmer quite a bit last time. We won't necessarily look at each and every one of these, but quite a few. Latimer and Ridley were burnt together. So this is a dual execution at Oxford. And Latimer made the most oft-quoted remark of the English Reformation as they were at the stake. He's reputed to have said, "Be of good comfort, Master Ridley, and play the man. For we shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out." So here you see the courage and the attempt on the part of Ridley to encourage Ridley as well. And we'll be talking about this particular statement in our discussion time. We'll keep that one in mind. Cranmer, now he's the one we looked at last time. He's the one that was so close to the king, and he's the one who did so much to bring about the movement of England to Protestantism. Cranmer's martyrdom made an even greater impression than even some of these other well-known leaders. He'd been subjected to increasing psychological pressure in prison to renounce Protestantism, and had even succumbed, driven in part by his extreme, almost abject reverence for monarchy. How could he defy his lawful sovereign? So apparently, one of the things about Cranmer, he was very committed to Protestantism, and the principles behind it, but he also had a very strong belief that you should obey the king or sovereign no matter what. Well, under Henry, that worked well for him. Under Mary, this is causing a conflict because now his Protestant beliefs were in conflict with his dedication to his sovereign, and he was very stressed by that. Despite his submission, Mary decided to make an example of Cranmer and burn him anyways. As a foremost figure of the Anglican Reformation, and don't forget, he was the man who had declared her mother's marriage to Henry VIII unlawful back in 1533, thus stigmatizing Mary as a bastard, and she didn't forget that. She wanted to make him pay. She wanted to make an example out of him. So at the place of execution in Oxford, now keep in mind, Cranmer had, well, I don't know if I told you this, but they tortured him to the point that he renounced his faith. And he was supposed to be executed anyways, and then he was going to get up and give a final, you know, talk to everybody telling them how he renounced his Protestant faith, and they were going to put him to death. However, he unexpectedly refused to read out his recantation and stunned everybody by vigorously reaffirming his Protestant faith, blaming himself for his cowardice in ever having renounced it, and denouncing the Pope as Antichrist. So good for him. As the flames rose round him at the stake, the old archbishop held out the hand which had signed the document of recantation so that it was the first part of his body to be burnt away. So this is a very vivid and gruesome demonstration on his part of, and also a firm commitment to the fact that he had been a coward in recanting, and he took the very hand that he had used to sign the paper and held it out over the fire voluntarily, allowed it to be charred as he was about to be burned completely to death anyways. And by this final act in death, Cranmer may have done more to sanctify the Protestant cause in English eyes than anything he had accomplished in his life. And that's really saying something, because he had done quite a bit to sanctify and advance the Protestant cause in his life, and yet that demonstrative act really, that's, you know, it's so repugnant, and yet at the same time so vivid that people, you know, people just don't forget something like that. And it really made an impression on people. In 1563, 5 years after Mary's death, the suffering of Protestants under her reign was highlighted in a book that you all have heard about, John Fox's Book of Martyrs. How many people have a copy of that book and have perhaps read it? If you haven't, I definitely recommend it. Fox had begun writing his book long before Mary's reign and originally conceived his work as a tribute to martyrs of all time. So he really just wanted to write a book about martyrs. But when he started seeing what was going on under Mary's reign, it gave his book a special focus. And so he was in Strasbourg in exile, and the focus of his book shifted, and he began giving more emphasis to the English Protestant martyrs in his book. But he still covers martyrs from other eras as well, including the apostles. This new focus may be seen in the full title of the book, so that we know it as Fox's Book of Martyrs. The actual title was Acts and Monuments of These Latter and Perilous Days, Touching Matters of the Church. So as you can see, it's not quite as pithy as Fox's Book of Martyrs, but which is probably why the title is no longer remembered, but there it is. The book soon became standard fare in the education of children, particularly among Puritans, and thus contributed to a long-lasting animosity against Catholics and their faith. So parents, especially Puritan parents, we'll talk about Puritans in a little bit here and then even more later in the series, they began training their children, and hey, this is what you might face. This is what Catholics do to Protestants. So next we're going to look at the leader who followed Bloody Mary. It's Queen Elizabeth I. And I put just it's hard to read because it's so small, but it's just kind of a little family tree to kind of show you graphically what's going on here, because we have several different people who are related here. So we have Henry VIII, we have Catherine of Aragon, and of course their daughter, Mary, which we just looked at, became Bloody Mary. We have Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, and we have her as she had Elizabeth I, who we're about to look at. And then there was another wife, Jane Seymour, who actually ruled for a very short time in between Bloody Mary and Elizabeth, but it was just a couple of days. She was the mother of Edward VI. And then he also had like three other wives that we haven't discussed and probably won't discuss. So Henry had quite a few wives and quite a few children, and at least three of them became monarchs. If you follow this line here, it's coming down from above. This is a bigger chart. We see that Newhouse starts down here under James I, which is where the King James Bible is published. He's from the House of Stuart. That's coming later. But anyhow, this is just kind of a bigger chart that I found out there that's kind of helpful in showing the monarchs in England at that time. So Queen Elizabeth. Mary died in 1558. She died during a flu epidemic. And rumor has it that because she was an evil person, she didn't wear her mask, and therefore she died of the flu. she died during the flu epidemic. People died from the flu even back then, and was succeeded by her half-sister, Elizabeth. She didn't rule very long. She only ruled for about a five-year period, fortunately. And Elizabeth, again, was the daughter of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, who was the second wife, who was supposed to give him a son and instead gave him another daughter. Charles V repeatedly suggested that Mary have her half-sister executed, but the bloody queen had not dared to go that far, and now her policies were undone by her successor. So Charles, I think, saw the writing on the wall. He said, you need to get rid of that other sister of yours. She's going to be trouble. And Mary, whether it was not politically expedient or whether she's just going to bring herself to do it because of family ties, I don't know. But she didn't do it and ended up, this queen came in and basically undid all her policies. So we have one queen undoing the work that previous ruled, then another one comes along and undoes all those work again. Again, something like we see today with presidents and executive orders. Of course, that's because our presidents are acting like kings. It's not the way it's supposed to work, but there you go. This was also the time when many who left the kingdom for religious reasons returned to their homeland, bringing with them Zwinglian and Calvinist ideas they'd learned on the continent. So when persecution became intense and Bloody Mary was killing Protestants left and right, many Protestants didn't stay around to see if it would happen to them. They got out of Dodge and they went to a safer place on somewhere in the continent. They would either go to Switzerland, to Zurich, to Strasbourg, whatever. And while they were on the continent, they were influenced by Zwingli and Calvinists, and now they brought back ideas with them from the continent as they come back into England to enjoy the freedoms that they now have under Elizabeth. Just as Mary had been a Catholic both out of conviction and out of political necessity, Elizabeth was a Protestant for similar reasons. If the head of the church in England was the Pope and not the king, and it followed that the marriage of Henry VIII with Catherine of Aragon was valid, and that Elizabeth, born from Anne Boleyn while Catherine still lived, was illegitimate. So here we have somebody who's driven by their childhood narrative, only from the opposite direction. So Paul IV, who was Pope at the time, recognized this reality and he didn't want to see England slip away from his grip. So he indicated that he was ready to declare Elizabeth a legitimate daughter of Henry, sort of expedient declaration on the part of the Pope, as long as she continued in the Roman communion. He was going to work out a little deal, a little compromise with her if she would be willing to do that. That way she wouldn't have to worry about being illegitimate. He'd declare her okay. And she could stay Catholic and everything would be good as far as the Catholics were concerned. Well, Elizabeth didn't even notify him of her elevation to the throne, and she recalled the English ambassador to Rome. She pulled back the ambassador and said, I'm not going to recognize Rome. Nothing to do with them. Although much more politically inclined than Mary, she had been brought up to believe that her father had been right in proclaiming himself the head of the Church of England, and she would not waver in that conviction. So that she stuck to that, and that made her, as a consequence, a fan of the Reformation and of pulling away from Catholicism. But Elizabeth was not a Protestant extremist, so she's not really strong theologically. It's not a theological commitment here, it's more of a political expedience. Nevertheless, it's helpful to the Protestant cause. But her ideal was a church whose practices were uniform, thus uniting the kingdom in common worship, but in which there would be great latitude for varying opinions. So in her mind, she didn't want to nail everything down theologically. She wanted to leave a lot of room for variation within Protestant belief. She felt like there could be Protestants that believe, you know, certain things here, or Protestants who varied in those beliefs, and all held the basic Protestant views. She was not in favor of Catholics, but she wanted to allow some freedom and some latitude, which was actually helpful for the growth of Protestantism. Within that church, there would be no place for either Roman Catholicism, Catholics were out, or extreme Protestantism. So extreme Protestants would be those who wanted to nail everything down and who would accept nothing else. She wouldn't have that. She said, you know, there has to be freedom and room for people to believe different things and for everybody to get along. But any moderate form of Protestantism would be acceptable as long as it participated in the common worship of the Church of England. She was willing to accept all kind of variation as long as they were willing to participate and play nice and get along with the other Protestants. Elizabeth's religious policy found expression of support in the new edition of the Common Book of Prayer, which was one of the big documents that is used by the Anglicans even to this day, and they put forth a lot of doctrinal content in that material. As an indication of her policy of theological inclusiveness, the new book combined the two different formulas that the earlier versions ordered ministers to use in the distribution of the bread. And the new text read as follows. Let's see if you can see the sort of accepting it both ways within the statement. Remember, the Lord's Supper was a big divisive point, even amongst Protestants. You had Luther not being willing to get with Calvin. There were some who leaned more toward a Christ is really, truly, physically present in the elements, and there were those who were all the way over here, let the Zwingli view, who believe that no, it's just a ceremony, it's just a memory, it's a memorial. It's not, Christ is not literally present in any sense. So that was a divide amongst Protestants. Of course, the Catholics went all the way to transubstantiation. She wasn't going there. But here's the statement: the body of our Lord Jesus Christ, which was given for thee, preserve thy body and soul unto everlasting life. Take and eat this in remembrance, that Christ died for thee. So this is a reference to the Lord's Supper. Take and eat in remembrance that Christ died for thee, and feed on him in thy heart by faith with thanksgiving. So she allows for those who think they're feeding on Christ physically, but she puts the little phrase in there, by faith, because those who want to view it as a memorial or a remembrance can say, well, by faith we're participating or eating. Eating Christ, but it's in your heart. Naturally, the purpose of this double formula was to accommodate the divergent opinions of those who believed that communion was simply an act of remembrance, and those who insisted it really partook of the body of Christ. So she tried to, as much as possible, have it both ways. And you know, maybe she got that to work. In our day, we're having people who want to have it both ways, but sometimes, depending on the issue, you can't have it both ways. That just doesn't always work. But as much as she could, she did. Her policy was also seen in the 39 Articles, which is kind of like the Church of England's doctrinal statement. In those 39 Articles, several Catholic doctrines and practices are explicitly rejected. Again, no room for Catholics, but there's no attempt to choose among the various Protestant views. She tried to keep it open for anybody in the Protestant camp. On the contrary, the articles seek to achieve a broad theology in which all but Roman Catholics and most doctrinaire Protestants could participate, unless you were very extreme, in which case they wouldn't have tolerance for that either. Ever since that time, this has been one of the main characteristics of the Anglican Communion, that is, the Church of England and those religions derived from it. This idea of kind of an openness kind of to various persuasions within the broader body. She kind of set a tone of moderation, which has apparently persisted to the present, and that's not always been good. During Elizabeth's reign, Catholicism continued a precarious existence in England. So Catholics were able to live, but they were being watched closely, and they were not accepted. They were not allowed to be considered official. Some Catholics took up the cause of Mary Stuart, the Queen of Scotland, who had been forced into exile in England. Were Elizabeth to declare it illegitimate, Mary Stuart would gain the English throne. And Mary Stuart was of a Catholic persuasion. She would have taken everything back just like Mary did. And there were those who knew that, and they were anxious to have her take Elizabeth's place, have Elizabeth declared illegitimate or thrown out. So therefore, Mary Stuart was the focal point of several conspiracies by Catholics whom the Pope had declared free from any obligation of obedience to Elizabeth. So the Pope did his thing, like he always does, and said to all the Catholic churches in England, you don't have to serve the Queen. I hereby declare you free from serving her. And that was one time how the Pope actually shut down all church services in England, but they can't anymore because there are those who have broken, much of England has broken free from the Pope's power. Some exiled Catholic leaders declared that Elizabeth was heretical, usurper, and plotted her downfall and the elevation of Mary Stuart to the throne of England. So there was a conspiracy thing going on. And it's not clear whether Mary participated in those things or inspired those things, but it's clear that she was involved in them. And so Elizabeth, after much hesitation, ordered that her husband be put to death. I mean, her cousin be put to death. I think it was just kind of hard for people to, you know, put people to death within the family. But in this case, she felt like it was necessary. Now, this may surprise you. The total number of those executed for religious reasons during Elizabeth's reign was approximately equal to those who died under her half-sister, Mary Tudor. You think, well, wait a minute. She was called Bloody Mary. Why don't we call her Bloody Elizabeth? Well, here's the thing. It needs to be remembered, Elizabeth's reign was almost 10 times as long as Mary's. She ruled for about 45 or 50 years, Elizabeth did, whereas Mary only ruled for about 5. So to have the same number of deaths spread out over 10 times as long a period is not as intense. So that's the difference. In any case, toward the end of Elizabeth's life, Catholics were indicating they were ready to distinguish between their religious obedience and to the Pope and their political and civil authority to the Queen. They were ready to compromise. They realized they weren't going to win, and they wanted to see if they could have peace and still keep their Catholicism and live peaceably in England. It was on the basis of this distinction they would eventually be allowed to practice their religion openly. So there was something worked out where the Catholics could remain in England and practice it openly. It was also toward the end of Elizabeth's reign that the Puritans began to grow in number. Now this is a group that we're going to hear more about as time goes on. The Puritans, you may know, are the ones who were very instrumental in bringing Christianity to America. So we'll be looking at that as time goes on. They were called Puritans because, inspired by Calvinist ideas, they insisted on the need to restore the pure practices and doctrines of the New Testament. Now, this is, in a sense, not a new thing. There's always within Christianity those groups that pull aside and say, we want to be pure. We want to go back to the basics. They were kind of one of those groups, only it was within Calvinism, within the Reformation, that they were wanting to do that. And they were very strict in their beliefs and probably didn't make Elizabeth real happy because she wanted to be moderate. Well, next week we're going to look at the Scottish Reformation. I don't know if anybody recognizes that statue. John Knox. That's right. John Knox is very instrumental in the Scottish Reformation. And so we're now ready for our discussion questions. I'll just read them off to you. One possible discussion question is Latimer's admonition to his fellow martyr Ridley to play the man, I take that to mean to be brave or courageous, is reminiscent of the biblical admonition to be watchful and stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong. Why do you think bravery is often associated with manhood? Aren't women brave? So we have this kind of, you know, play the man, act like men, and I take it to be a reference to bravery. Obviously, we know women can be brave. What's the deal with that? What do you think about that? What does it mean for a martyr to be brave? Is it important for a martyr to be brave? Why or why not? In a previous church we were in, we used to watch movies like we watch in our church. And I remember talking with the pastor of that church after we watched one of these movies where the martyr was seen, you know, burned at the stake, and he was, you know, crying out to God, you know, that he had faith, and he was showing himself to be strong and not, you know, screaming as he went out. And the pastor made a comment, what's wrong with the martyr screaming as he goes out? I mean, why do they have to not scream? You know, they're in pain. I mean, what's the big deal? So I'm asking the question, assuming that's what it means to be brave, that you go out with, you know, stiff upper lip, so to speak. Is that important? Is there a problem with showing that you're in pain? Why or why not? What do you think about all that? Last question. We have become accustomed to Christians never being under the threat of martyrdom. Do you think that could change in our lifetime? If so, are you prepared to be brave if faced with martyrdom? So there are our questions.